This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, we'll hear from Hartford's Asylum Quartet, the first saxophone ensemble to win the International Chamber Music Ensemble competition in Boston. But first, St. Patrick's Day earlier this week is a holiday full of parades and parties and wearing copious amounts of green. Ireland is celebrated with beer and shamrocks, but the history and culture of Ireland that brought many ancestors to America is one full of pain. Millions fled their native land because of a deadly famine. In the mid-19th century, Ireland lost almost 3 million people. More than 1 million died from starvation and related diseases, and 2 million emigrated.
The potato blight that led to famine in Ireland between 1845 and 1852 first appeared in September 1845. The country continued to produce great quantities of food, and landlords continued to take rents, while one in every eight people died of hunger. It was not the first time that the potato had failed and that people had starved, but the impact of this failure was significant for several reasons. The population had grown dramatically in the early 19th century, doubling from 4 to 8 million in just 60 years. Ironically, this was largely due to the potato, an acre of which could feed an entire family for nearly a year. Of those 8 million in the 1840s, 7 million lived on the land. Most depended almost entirely on the potato for sustenance.
That's audio from a video that greets you at Ireland's Great Hunger Museum in Hamden, Connecticut. It's part of Quinnipiac University. Today, Where We Live, we'll take you on an audio tour of the Great Hunger Museum, which features some of the art and sculpture that came out of the famine experience. You can follow along with photos at WNPR.org. Quinnipiac Journalism Professor Emeritus Paul Janich has been instrumental in getting the museum off the ground in its first year and a half.
I'm half Irish, and my grandfather's side of the family was from Cork, which suffered greatly during the hunger. Maybe it was the worst area. And my grandmother's family came from County Kerry, from an estate where they were in the equivalent of sharecroppers in the United States, tenant farmers. And the name of the estate was Muckross, which is Irish for Peninsula Full of Pigs, which I think is a wonderful name. And they came to the United States, and they were poor, but they prospered, and they ended up in the Midwest and became successful. So it's a typical Irish story. So it means a lot to me personally. As a journalist, I'm fascinated with this story that I don't think has been told adequately, even in Ireland until recent years. You know, the Irish like to think of themselves as heroes and poets, not as destitute, starving people. And so even in Ireland, the Great Hunger was downplayed in the schools. The interest was revived in the late 90s in the 150th anniversary of the start of the Great Famine. And scholars looked at it, and it started to be part of the educational system. And now it's a respectable subject in Ireland, and it's starting to be one in the United States. Now, this is the only museum like it in North America, and it's perhaps the only one in the world that's devoted entirely to artifacts and art and not documents, or at least not very many documents. So this is... Quinnipiac has really started something unusual and, in a sense, unique, and I'm very proud to be part of it.
Grace Brady is the director of the Hunger Museum. She also feels a personal connection to the story.
My entire career has been in the museum background. I was at the Metropolitan Museum of Art for over 20 years prior to this, and what pulled me was the personal side of it because I am completely Irish. And so that was what pulled me to look into it. My grandparents emigrated out of Ireland post-famine, obviously. But so it really resonated with me, the story, and it being an art museum was the other pull. So it was kind of a nice combination.
Probably throughout our tour, I'll be asking you some of those personal questions because I'm sure it all of this means quite a lot to you. But I'll just start by asking... has anything about the history, as you've been working on this, surprised you? Stories or textures or something that you just never knew or you'd never really come to grips with?
Oh, I feel like, yes. I feel like I'm learning something every day. And I knew what a lot of the general public knew about the famine, just the general facts. But it's so much more complicated than that. And that's why this place is so important to get that story out. But I'm also surprised at the stories that I hear from visitors. Some are very common to my family, extended family growing up, and some obviously aren't. Some are very different. So that's surprising to me. And also the level of Irish art. I knew some Irish art, like the top ones, Jack Yeats, but I was really not that familiar with some of the other artists in the collection.
I'm going to have you take us on a tour and start where you would start someone who's coming here for the very first time. So explain where we are right now.
Sure. Well, the museum, just to give you a broad sense, the architects who designed the museum were charged with making it appear like a workhouse, which was one of the relief measures put in place at the time of the famine. And if you look from the outside, it's very plain and simple, and that's what the exterior of a workhouse looked like. And then inside, it's a two-level museum. On the lower level, it's the 19th century collection where we are now, and the ceilings are very low. And that, in some ways, gives you a feeling of either being on a ship when you're emigrating out of Ireland or how some of the people lived in very hovel-like spaces. And then as we go upstairs, you'll see the ceilings are much higher. It's brighter, representing sort of emigrating out of and immigrating into a new life or a new country. So we're downstairs right now, and we're in front of probably the keystone painting in our collection. It's called Irish Peasant Children by Daniel MacDonald. And the reason it's the keystone is it's the only painting in our collection that was done during the time of the famine. So it was painted in 1847, or Black 47, as it was often referred to, because it was the worst year in the famine. And the most interesting part of this painting is if you looked at it, people would say, well, it doesn't seem to make sense that that would be painted during that time because the children look healthy. There's three children. The girl in the middle of the painting looks like your typical Western Irish, and the little guy in the upper right-hand corner with his hair askew is mischievous and something's going on there. But the most concerning person is the girl on the left, and she's not looking at you, and she's holding a bottle that's sort of cocked like a gun or a missile, and so there's definitely turmoil there. And then in the background you see a lot of the clouds, storm is brewing. So the painter was very, the artist was very clever. He needed to make a living, as artists did, and he knew that if he painted starving people or ravaged lands, no one is going to purchase that or hang it in their home. So he had patrons he was trying to have buy his works. And so this is a very beautiful painting. It's beautifully executed, and the image is nice to look at. But behind that, there's a much deeper story, and that's one of the reasons it's such a special painting for us in our collection.
Where do you want to go next?
I'd like to go to the next one, to the right. This is a painting by James Brennan called The Finishing Touch, which was done in 1876, so post-famine, and it tells sort of the emigration story. It's a picture of a local sign maker carving onto a traveling trunk the name of the girl in the picture who's traveling, her name's O'Connor, and where she is headed, which is New York. And the father's leaning over the trunk looking very downtrodden, as I'm imagining that would be like sending your child off. So this was a typical story at the time, and I think the painting is a typical interior, so it's a really beautiful work and very appropriate to our story. And James Brennan was a very well-known artist at the time.
One of the things about this immigration story that's maybe different than what we perceive of a lot of the immigration to America over the course of a century or so is there's this narrative of people trying to make a better life or to escape from some sort of religious tyranny. This seems like a sadder immigration story, and I'm sure it shows up in the art. It seems as though it's one that is not brought on by some need to make things better, but just to survive.
I think there's definitely part of that. People were looking for a way to survive because they were destitute, and their whole family couldn't go because they couldn't afford it, but they were willing to at least send one at a time if somebody could go and have a better life. And maybe it wasn't a great life, but it was better than where they were. So it is a very somber story, I think, because it is famine-related. You know, there are a lot of immigration stories, but it's people are choosing that because they want a better life, but their life was not destitution at the time. So I'm sure there are other immigration stories, and it happens today as we see famines exist and people are looking to go to a better place. But you're right, it is a very somber reason why people emigrated out. These two will talk about this. We have plenty of sculptures in our collection by John Behan, who's a Galway artist, and this sculpture we're looking at is called Famine, Mother, and Children. And it's based on an iconic image in the Illustrated London News of Bridget O'Donnell and her children who were evicted and starving. And it's several artists use this image in their collection, and we'll see one upstairs by another sculptor. Very textual. You know, people spend a lot of time at John Behan's sculptures, and he's known throughout Ireland and the world and has different life-size pieces in Ireland as well as in New York near the UN. There's one of his, The Arrival, The New Dawn, which is a ship where people are coming to the new country. So this is sort of an iconic image, and that's why I love having it in the museum. Harrowing but beautiful. And here's Jack Yates. We have two Jack Yates paintings now. This one is called A Young Man's Troubles, and it's a watercolor. And I love this one because I had a conversation with some visitors, and the way most people look at this and read it is there's the young man on the left, they're at the bar, and behind him are the notices to other countries, Australia, Canada, America. And then there's two older gentlemen on the other opposite side of the bar drinking, and it's as if they're sort of listening or thinking about what is this young man deciding. It's probably a tough decision. One woman I spoke to said, which I had never viewed it this way, was that the young man was listening to the older gentleman, maybe trying to get their take or see if they had any wisdom for him. So it's a beautiful piece, but it's obviously appropriate to the museum for the immigration reasons.
Could you just describe to our listeners who Jack Yates was?
Jack Yates, many people know William Butler Yates, and Jack is William's brother. And their father, John Yates, was also a portrait painter and quite a talented family, to say the least. But Jack Yates was the foremost Irish painter of his time. And to have any of him in our collection is a huge deal. So when I came to the museum and this was already in the collection, I was thrilled. So this is, as I just mentioned, the Illustrated London News page that shows Bridget O'Donnell and children. It's from December of 1849. So that's where that image came from, and it's such an important one in the Irish story that you will see it in many things, not just in artists' works, but in when people are promoting anything Irish, or you'll see that image quite frequently.
It's in the Illustrated London News. The illustrations of the time in foreign newspapers told an awful lot of the story, not always necessarily for the better. I know that that's a part of the collection. Can you talk a bit more about that influence of how the journalists, the newspapers of the time, were capturing images and words of the famine and what story it told?
Well, at the time of the famine, photography was in its infancy, so there really are no photographic images to speak of. There are some post-famine of some evictions and things like that. But this is the way the world and the general public learned about what was happening in other countries. And the Illustrated London News was one of the most popular publications. So they would send out artists or sketch artists to go to Ireland. And one famous one is James Mahoney. And they're artists in their own right. You can see just by looking at the sketches, they're like drawings and engravings, and it takes serious talent to do. So to me, it's a very interesting thing where in the history and the facts with people saying, oh, well, we didn't know about Ireland. Well, they were in your newspapers, so somebody knew, and it was a London newspaper.
I wanted to ask Paul Janich, our friend and journalism professor at Quinnipiac University, to be part of this conversation. We were just talking about the journalism of the time and the story that it told. Do you have anything to add to this? It's a very important part of the story, I think.
I do have something to add, particularly the graphic representation. Much of it is quite remarkable. It's good journalism. It shows what was happening. I think it has a certain dramatic impact, more than just words. But some of the graphic representation is very unsympathetic, and it portrays the Irish as looking like monkeys, particularly the men, when in fact we are told by historians that the Irish even then were an especially attractive group. The men were tall and muscular, the women were shapely and had beautiful faces, and yet these lithographs show them as looking like animals, done by unsympathetic artists and processed by unsympathetic editors and engravers back at the newspaper.
And these unsympathetic editors and journalists, we'll call them, were telling a kind of a narrative that was part of British lore at the time. We didn't want the Irish here. We didn't want the dirty Irish here, and we didn't want them starving in our streets, and so we're going to portray them in a very demeaning way.
The line was, it's their own fault. It's their own fault that they relied on the potato for their nourishment. It's their own fault that they're starving to death. It's their own fault that they have diseases because they're not clean people. It's all their fault. It's not our fault, we the British, or we anybody else. It's their own fault.
You're listening to a tour from Ireland's Great Hunger Museum here on Where We Live. We were at Quinnipiac University earlier this week. You're hearing from journalism professor emeritus Paul Janich and museum director Grace Brady. To follow along with photos from the museum, go to WNPR.org. More after this break. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, Hartford's Asylum Quartet, the first saxophone ensemble to win the International Chamber Music Ensemble competition. Today we're broadcasting an interview that we did from Ireland's Great Hunger Museum at Quinnipiac University earlier this week. Grace Brady is director of the museum. She's now going to take us upstairs.
Coming up the staircase, if you look at the actual staircase, the design of it, it's meant to evoke an ocean wave because people coming from Ireland to somewhere else. And the painting at the top of this staircase was one when we were installing the collection that we had a group vote on what should be here. And this one was picked for several reasons. My reasoning for voting on this one was my background is all museum training, and I want people to want to come to museums. So even if you have a non-museum goer or someone who doesn't know anything about art, when you look at this picture by Lillian Davidson called Burying the Child, you know something very grim and horrible is happening. And the painting itself is extremely well done. The execution is impeccable. The color choice is amazing. And it's sort of Picasso-esque, you know, the blue period. So you see the mother on the left holding the child. And I like to think she has a lot of dignity in the way she's holding her dead baby, and then the husband, I'm assuming, in the middle, digging the hole for the baby. And then the poor soul on the right is almost gone in another world. He's just gazing out at us. So it's a very tough picture, but it's a beautiful, beautiful painting. And I think anybody can get what's happening here, whether you know about the Great Hunger, know about museums, know about art. And that was one of the reasons why I loved this one being right here.
It's kind of a ghost story. I mean, these people look as though they're barely alive themselves, and it's almost a haunted painting. And I would assume that someone who's Irish post-famine painting about this time period would would feel a bit haunted by these people.
I think very much so. And there's several other artists you'll see who have mentioned that they've heard stories from their grandparents or their parents and walking the land, and are you walking over graves to your own grave, you know, that whole idea. So that's a very good point about ghost imagery or thought. This big stained glass piece on the second level is called An Gorta Mór, which is the Irish for the Great Hunger. And it was done by an artist, Robert Balla, who doesn't normally work in stained glass, but this piece was commissioned for the museum. There are two pieces commissioned, and this was one of them. And it's a beautiful triptych. This is, again, another reason I like this. It tells a story that anybody can sort of understand just by observing it. On the left side of the triptych, there's a woman in the field, and the potato's healthy, and there's fire and heat coming from their home. And then in the middle piece, on the left side, the potato crop is thriving, but on the right side, you see the blight has occurred and the potato crop is dead. And then on the right side of the third piece of the triptych, there's an eviction scene, the British soldier evicting a family, people walking towards a ship in the distance. So in one piece, it tells the whole story in a really beautifully visual way.
And we've talked a bit about the immigration story, but this eviction from people's homes, this is in a very important part of the story, essentially evicting people who didn't have the money to pay rent. What little money they had was going to food, and then they're turned out onto the streets or into the fields and just, I assume, left to die. This, I think, probably informs an awful lot of the feeling of the Irish post-famine and during the famine to Britain that kind of persists today.
The different few stories that I know about evictions, evicting people in the middle of the night in winter, I mean, there's something very wrong about that, whether they've paid their rent or not. So there was this sort of systematic thinking by the British government, and I always like to say government and not people, because governments are the ones who make the decisions, and there were English citizens who sent relief to the Irish as well. So they wanted the land, and they would use whatever means. People couldn't pay the rent. It was like a catch-22. You can't pay the rent. You don't have enough money for food. You get kicked out. You go to a workhouse that's put up temporarily. There's disease in the workhouse. You can't go back to your land, even if you got healthy. And so it was this cycle of there was no real way they could get a leg up. And the British felt, as Paul mentioned, the Irish brought it on themselves.
Mm. We've done programs before about terminology, and the use of the word genocide is something that's really, it's weighty, and it's something that people don't throw around casually. But often we don't call things genocide that seemingly are, and this has all the hallmarks of something that was intentional, truly intentional.
Yeah, that's definitely a hot button, the genocide discussion, and there are historians who would say it's definitely genocide. You have your Tim Pat Coogans, who wrote The Famine Plot, who would 100% say it was genocide. Then you have John Kelly, who wrote The Graves Are Walking, who is more moderate, saying it was definitely crimes against humanity. But in order to call something genocide, there are strict measures that you have to make. Another phrase that some people use, which I think is very interesting, is cultural genocide. That resonates with me the most. Not only did they destroy people and kill people, but they killed the land, they killed the culture, they killed the dancing, they killed the writing. So it's a big issue. I would never be one to be able to say it's genocide, it's not genocide, because it's much more complicated than a sound bite.
But it's something that you have to grapple with in this museum. This is one of the possible realities, and certainly one of the ways that a lot of people could see this.
Absolutely. What's very interesting, John Kelly made a point. He said when he gives his talks on his book in America, the Irish Americans all say it's genocide. He goes, but when I go to Ireland and I give my talk, they don't say it's genocide. They're not happy with the situation by any means. But it's a very interesting, you know, the Irish Americans, they're here because they were forced out. So it's a whole big discussion that I find fascinating and, you know, to me requires a lot more reading on.
Do you see in putting together this museum and having these discussions, do you see a large difference between the way the Irish expat community, the diaspora, views this as opposed to Irish people who still call Ireland home?
I am learning that, and it's a huge lesson for me because I am Irish American and my ancestors, you know, my grandmother, I tell this story all the time when I was a young child, sitting on the couch, and she had her Manhattan next to her. She always had her one Manhattan. And we would be watching TV, and the news would come on, and anything political that came on, under her breath, she would say, England out of Ireland. And I was too young. I didn't understand what that meant. But very deep-seated, and if you spoke to my parents today, I mean, I'm educating my mom a bit more now, but she would say, absolutely genocide. I said, well, you need to come and see some of these things. But then my Irish colleagues on the other side, not all of them, but some, their thinking is, it was a long time ago, it was awful, but we want to move on. We've prospered and we've accomplished, and it really is a difference of opinion and feeling.
I guess, Grace, you want to just show us one last thing before we're through?
Sure.
So what are we looking at?
So this is another piece by John B. Hahn, and it's called The Famine Ship or The Coffin Ship. And the piece we have in the collection is a maquette of an original life-size piece in County Mayo in Croagh-Patrick. And it's very dramatic, apparently. I've never seen the one in Croagh-Patrick, but apparently as you're walking up to it, you slowly realize, you don't realize until you get to it, that the sails are made of skeletons. And when in the maquette, you see it much more clearly because you're up close. And the idea, obviously, being that many people who emigrated out, they were called coffin ships because a lot of people did not survive the trip. The conditions were poor. A lot of the ships were not meant for passengers, but cargo. Disease was rampant. Nutrition was not there. And so if you did survive a trip on a coffin ship, you know, it was a great thing, but many people perished.
I've been to several museums, both in the U.S. and overseas, that take a look back at the Holocaust, for instance, and they're sometimes overwhelmingly sad places to be. I'm wondering if you could just, as a final thought, tell us about some of what you hear from people who maybe see some of these things for the first time, because there is a lot of grim imagery and there's a lot of things that make you really think very, very deeply, more so than a lot of museums you would go to. What are some things you hear from people who are experiencing this for the first time?
Well, I hear a lot of that it's very sad, and many people tear up by looking at certain objects. And one woman in particular, I remember early on when I first started and I would walk through the gallery just to sort of see what people thought. She goes, this is a lovely museum, but there's really no hope here. Mm-hmm. And I said to her, you know, I respect that you feel that. I said, my view of it is that there actually is hope here, that because we exist, there's hope, and that artists are expressing themselves. That's getting, you know, you're going through it, you're living it, and you're putting it out there. You know, in order to get through anything, good or bad, you have to go through it and live it and experience it. And so it was a nice conversation with this woman, and I felt for her, and there are many people like that. Yesterday we had a huge day here, and people came and a few of them said to me, you know, I'm from Sligo, I'm from here, and they had tears in their eyes, and they said, you know, I'm so happy this is here and it's so important. And so while it's a sadness, there's also a contentment and I like to say joy, I love that word, that can come from it. So it is a sad experience. I mean, I'm here every day. And but there's a lot of hope here, and it's important that we're here.
And I'll just say, it's to me, it's not a sad place just because the art is beautiful. It's just inspiring, and I think that that's what I'm left with. Grace, thanks so much for talking. I really appreciate it.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
In the 1940s, the Irish Folklore Commission conducted interviews with thousands of elderly people around Ireland who remember stories from their ancestors who'd survived the famine. These stories were collected and edited by Cathal Portier for the book Famine Echoes. These recollections were curated into a live presentation by Professor Emeritus of Journalism Paul Janich. Reading here is Quinnipiac University Department of Visual and Performing Arts Professor Andrew Scott.
P. Foley, County Wicklow. Everybody was remarking to each other how dark the sky was. The old people all said they never saw such a colored sky before. The people went to bed in fear and dread that some great calamity was about to befall them. Next morning, when they awoke and went out, to their consternation, their lovely potato plants, which were in such bloom and showed such a promise of beautiful crops the day before, were all covered over with black spots, and the leaves and stalks hanging down as if dead. John Doyle, County Wicklow. The people ate crab apples and holly berries and the leaves of the crab apple tree. They climbed trees for nuts at Redna. The favorite was the oak nut. Many were so weak they fell out of the trees and were killed. They fought and killed each other over the blackberries before they were ripe. Trees were climbed at night in search of crows and wood pigeon eggs. And they would eat every bird of all descriptions that they could catch. The people around Ockram had snares for killing mice. They skinned and gutted them. One man saw a rat and a weasel fighting and tried to kill both of them, but the weasel bit him, and he was so weak that the poison from the bite killed him. Patrick O'Dempsey, County Galway. They'd steal sheep. Why wouldn't they? They had to put a bell on the sheep's neck. When the bell would ring out, he, the steward, would go out then and hunt them that would be stealing. And sure, 'twas no sin, and you starving, to steal whatever you could to eat. Thomas O'Flynn, County Mayo. The black favor followed. This appeared in black spots, which gradually crossed the body. Lips became bloodless. Death followed in the home if they were not removed to the workhouse hospital. And there seems to be no tradition that anyone catching the disease survived. It was dreaded more than the actual hunger, and when persons were found dead in the fields or along the road, their own kith and kin often denied knowing them. Peter Clark, County Cavan. Dr. Adams of Lower Knockhyde was after finishing his medical course. He told me it was most terrifying to drive along the road and see a corpse lying here and a corpse lying there, and some of them seemed as if they had been trying to get as near as possible to the cemetery. Both sides of the road were strewn with them.
That's Quinnipiac University Department of Visual and Performing Arts Professor Andrew Scott, reading from the book Famine Echoes. These recollections were curated into a live presentation by Professor Emeritus of Journalism Paul Janich at Ireland's Great Hunger Museum at Quinnipiac University. If you want to see pictures from our tour of the Great Hunger Museum, go to WNPR.org. Thanks to intern Jane Ashley for her help with our tour, which was produced by executive producer Katie Talarski. Coming up next, we'll hear from Hartford's Asylum Quartet, the first saxophone ensemble to win the International Chamber Music Ensemble competition in Boston. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on Monday's show, House Speaker Brendan Sharkey has a tax plan that's opened some eyes. It suggests taxing nonprofit institutions like hospitals and colleges, then letting them negotiate a tax deal with towns. It's a total reversal on the way we do things now, a system that often leaves towns shortchanged. We'll also talk with outgoing Senate President Don Williams. I hope he can join us. The words classical music and quartet usually mean one thing to people: two violins, viola, and cello, the classic string quartet. But the Asylum Quartet, based in Hartford, is one soprano, one alto, one tenor, and one baritone saxophone. And this quartet just became the first of its kind to win the International Chamber Music Ensemble competition in Boston. In the first installment of a new series we'll be featuring about the arts, the Asylum Quartet stopped by our Studio 3 right here on Asylum Avenue in Hartford to play some of the music that helped them win, and also to play a piece close to our hearts, the Where We Live theme song. Welcome in Joseph Abad, Tony Speranza, Max Schwimmer, and Andrew Barnhart, the Asylum Quartet. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
So first of all, where does the name Asylum Quartet come from?
Actually, right here on Asylum Avenue, coincidentally, which is the street we're on right now. So,
and why? What all brought you together?
Well, we all are from somewhat far away, actually, and we all met as graduate students right here at the Hart School. And we were took a really long time to find a name for the group, and we settled on Asylum.
Yeah, and it's a great name because it has a few different meanings, but you know, I think the whole idea of the saxophone quartet is kind of a new thing to a lot of people. The very idea that a saxophone quartet exists, frankly, is something that a lot of people don't even know. Tell us about the sax quartet as a form.
Well, the sax quartet has been around for a while. It was actually started in the French military bands. It was the saxophone section in the military bands at the end of the 19th century, and it then kind of evolved. The saxophone section from that band would perform separately as a quartet. And throughout the 20th century, it's kind of grown, and there's a lot of it's very prominent in new music. A lot of composers love writing for saxophone quartets because they're so colorful and because saxophone players just love playing new music and exploring new sounds.
We're talking with the Asylum Quartet today on the program. They recently became the first saxophone quartet to win the International Chamber Music Ensemble competition in Boston. And this is Where We Live. And congratulations on that. That's quite
an
honor.
Thank you so much.
I mean, this is an unusual thing. Who are you competing against in this competition?
Mostly string ensembles and piano trios and other very established chamber ensembles with long histories. So it was really exciting for us to be involved in something like that as a saxophone quartet, which is a newer ensemble.
A bit later on, we're going to hear a more contemporary piece, but let's listen to a little bit of one of the pieces that you performed. It's a quartet by Alexander Glazunov, and it's a variation on a Chopin piece. Could you talk about this?
Yeah, so the middle movement of this work, which is a much larger work for saxophone quartet, is a theme in several variations, and this is the variation that's influenced by Chopin.
That's the Asylum Quartet. I want to hear another piece that you performed at this competition and that we recorded here. Tell us about this, because as you said, I think a lot of the music for saxophone quartet is more modern music. And this is, I think, a really beautiful, another very kinetic piece that includes a lot of movement and a lot of fast playing.
Yeah. This piece was written by Guillermo Lago. He's a Dutch composer. It was written in 2011, but it's a piece that's growing. It's called Ciudades. The movement is called Cordoba. Other movements in the piece are Sarajevo and Addis Ababa, but I believe he's also added two other movements as of late. So this one is very, very Latin American influence, kind of Spanish influence, just that flavor there, those colors. And it basically indexes his travels with those three cities. And it's been a great process just putting all this together. You'll hear a lot of interweaving among voices and just, as you had mentioned, just communication orally through all these, you know, all these lines and whatnot. So
let's listen to the Asylum Quartet. That's music from Asylum Quartet. They're a saxophone quartet that's playing live in our Studio 3 and speaking with us here on Where We Live. They just became the first saxophone quartet to win the International Chamber Music Ensemble competition in Boston. They met here in Hartford at Hart School, and they take their name from Asylum Hill, where we reside, where we live here on the program. We're going to hear one more piece that you actually worked up special for us that I'm very, very pleased with. But one thing I wanted to ask about was tone. Obviously, in a string quartet, string players have their own sounds and their own ways of playing. But I think to the layman's ear, it's not as distinct as a vocal quartet or certainly a saxophone quartet where you're producing these very, very human sounds. talk about blending the various tones. If one of the four of you left the group, I'm quite sure it would sound very different, right?
Yeah, that's true. You know, we work a lot on blend and sound, and I think that is one of the things that distinguishes how we sound as opposed to how a jazz saxophone quartet sounds, or a string quartet, as you mentioned. But we all have, I think, very similar concepts of sound. We listen to the same recordings, and in our training, we played the same pieces and had some of the same teachers. And it's just, I think it's something, we also all play all of the saxophones, so we kind of have some empathy for each other, knowing what we're all going through, basically. So I think we are able to kind of meet each other and create that blend.
I need to ask before we run out of time, what is next for you guys? Because it seems as though you're on this amazing upward trajectory as you're building this career and winning competitions. What do you guys do next?
Well, we've got a gig on the 30th of March in Vernon. We'll be doing that, and we are basically trying to, like you had mentioned, gather a lot of steam and momentum here, especially with the New England area. We've got several gigs out of state in Michigan at the Traverse City Film Festival.
We'll be playing at the New Haven International Festival of Arts and Ideas this summer. We're really excited about that.
From what I understand, on the main stage, which will be great. A lot of people get to see that.
Yeah, that'll be cool. And it'll be like the first time we've done something like that. And so I think it's kind of a new thing for a saxophone quartet to do something like that. So we're really excited about those kind of things.
That concert we were talking about is March 30th at 4 p.m. at St. John's Episcopal Church in Vernon. We'll have more information on our website, WNPR.org. So before we go, we're going to hear one more piece. And, you know, we've been thinking about doing this for years and talking to different musicians about doing this. You worked up a version of our theme song, which is a piece called Flim by Aphex Twin, Richard James. It's been our theme song since the very beginning. We've played variations, jazz variations, that others have recorded, but no one's ever done one specifically to be on the show. So can you just quickly talk about what went into this?
Yeah, we got the email from Lydia here and had a great friend of ours, composer friend, Ryan Jesperson, who took on the project in a matter of hours, basically, and scored it for four of us and interesting other sounds. It's been great just putting it all together and really working with Ryan also.
Thanks to the Asylum Quartet for sharing their music with us today. Joseph Abad, Tony Speranza, Max Schwimmer, and Andrew Barnhart. To hear and to see more of the kinetic performance of the Asylum Quartet, go to WNPR.org, where you can find them playing in Cafe Cutie, the little kitchen area on our floor where we live fuels up with coffee. You can also visit their website, asylumquartet.com. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Flim. It's the theme song to Where We Live. It's originally by Aphex Twin, but performed here by the Asylum Quartet on Where We Live.